This episode of our This Week in XR podcast is sponsored by Zapper. Zapper is one of the world's leading XR companies. Over the past 12 years, they've won numerous awards for memorable campaigns. They've democratized AR by making tools and SDKs that anyone can use. And they created Zapbox, the world's most affordable mixed reality headset. Most recently, Zapper worked with Unilever to create an enhanced QR code called Accessible QR, which enables packaged goods to speak to the blind and partially sighted. If you're thinking XR, give the team at Zapper a call or visit zapper.com to see how they can help you on your XR journey. Good morning, everybody, or I should say good evening, because instead of Friday morning, it is a Monday night. Ted's on the East Coast. I'm here bringing up the rear on the West Coast, and Roni is I don't know where. But we are joined today by an incredible guest, Yatsuyu, the chairman of Animoca Brands. That is the reason that this is tonight instead of Friday. We thought it was worth rescheduling the show to get someone as significant as Yat, who has really been driving the metaverse as much as any individual or any company. So I'm fascinated to hear what he has to say. There's a bit of a thawing in the crypto winter, and they're very tied up with Web3 and all things crypto. So that should be an interesting interview. He's a billionaire. So, I mean, worth waiting for.
Always good to listen to a billionaire that's dealing with crypto. It'll be an interesting, interesting experience, I think.
So every time I feel like, oh, there wasn't a lot of news this week, there always is a lot of news. But let's see if we can knock it off in about 10 minutes, starting with Perplexity, raising another $63 million and rising to a value of $2.5 billion. Mm. So this is yet another search. I guess this is more of a search engine based AI. I have used it a bunch of times. It strikes me as being very similar to the others. I have a very hard time differentiating between a lot of these. They vary in their qualities of image generation, but in terms of their text features and their ability to help me write stories or do research, they seem about equal. So I don't know how all this is going to shake out. It's a very confusing situation with so many chatbots on so many devices.
Yeah, it's certainly an odd time, this sort of mad rush to LLM the world, right? And 7-8 companies now pouring, I mean, we're hundreds of billions of into this, you know, as an overall global effort. And there's a lot of duplication of services and efforts, which isn't, you know, too dissimilar to Web 2. We had many, many search engines at the beginning.
That's
they
true.
Dropped out. There were a few that were left standing. We may see the same. And of course, you'll have to forgive me this week because I'm literally in a fishing camp in the middle of nowhere in the Blue Ridge Mountains this week. So I have not been paying attention to the news at all. I've been fly fishing all day. And so I'm getting the updates live just like the rest of the world is.
I know. And there was interesting Paramount news today, too, your alma mater.
Was indeed. So, my good friend Bob Backish is apparently no longer with the company. So he only lasted about a month after me.
Well,
wish him the best.
Yeah, well, he's a well-liked guy.
He's a very well-liked guy and a very nice individual, and I respect him tremendously, and I literally hope the best for him. I hope it all works out.
I think when your company is about to be sold, everything gets thrown overboard that the acquirer may not want.
Yeah,
it's very including odd. Bob Backish and Ted Shilowitz.
Yeah.
But of course, getting rid of the futurist makes total sense. If you're selling your company,
so.
You have no future.
If you don't care about the future, I guess it makes sense.
So Meta, after going from about 100 stock, a value of $100 a share, went to $532 a share with the thawing of the metaverse and the increased interest in AI. And of course, they've done some amazing stuff with AI, although they don't have a clue how they're going to make money from it. They are buying an awful lot of compute from NVIDIA, and they are positioning themselves to be a major, major player. And I don't know, investors heard about the scale of the investment between AI and XR, and it spooked them, and the stock has fallen 20%. So I guess, meanwhile, they're, you know, PE, which is how companies are valued, is very similar to its peers, around 30 or high 20s. Yeah. So Really, really interesting times. Like, still huge volatility among tech companies, even though AI seems to be floating all boats. It seems like that may be going to change soon.
The one thing I did get wind of today, which I'm not sure if it's real or not, is apparently Microsoft is building some huge data lake in the middle of nowhere to populate all these GPUs to run OpenAI. Is this just some strange rumor, or is
I
this
haven't seen
confirmed?
that today. I have not
Very
seen that
weird stuff.
today.
I mean, there's very weird stuff going on in the world right now, Charlie. When, companies are devoid of valuation, they're devoid of profitability, and people just keep buying. So we'll see what happens, I guess.
Well, so Nick, here's an XR story. Going back to our old-fashioned bread and butter, Meta took its operating system and open sourced it, right? So they're going to
Well,
open
pseudo
up.
kind of open sourced
They're
it, right?
going to open up
Selectively.
their app store, significant, right? So all those app labs things are going to suddenly get much more access. So
Very much like the Android iOS split amongst
well, don't you
the
think it's
convention.
motivated by they don't want to go head to head with Android, so the best thing to do is make it free.
Well, I also think it's a bit of the long game, the Zuckerberg long game, right? I think always he had his sense on he would never be able to compete with today's devices with an operating system. So he put a bet on the belief that tomorrow's devices he could build a third valid operating system for and see if he could put that out into the world and it would catch on. Now, VR has certainly caught on to a certain extent, but it is nowhere near any kind of mainstream usability or profitability. But it is an interesting sort of long bet on we need three OSs. We need more than just Android and iOS. And he's thinking his Meta OS could be the third player. And then that would effectively cure all the ills of the 70, 80 billion spent on XR. Maybe there's a logic to that. Maybe.
It was wisely praised as a decision, including among others, Oculus founder Palmer Luckey, whose comment was he hopes it's not too late, because it was always his intention to have an open source solution that would undergird the entire industry.
And I must tell you, using the Vision Pro more and more, it is a remarkable experience to hop into your spatial Mac. And outside of all the foibles of this device that we've talked about, not balanced, too heavy, problematic hardware, but the software experience, if you're a Mac person like I certainly am, I'm drifting further away from the idea of using my Meta OS because yes, you can sort of do all the same stuff, but it's just clunkier in the Meta world, and maybe the games will start to find their way into the Apple Vision Pro, and then I will very rarely use my Quest 3, although I think I'm probably going to stay in both ecosystems. And I think people that are enthusiasts like me will use their Mac OS for their spatial computing and their Meta OS for their spatial gaming. And I think that's probably the next 5 years of everybody's life.
Well, what an interesting perspective. Well, that certainly is going to force me to segue to the story about the Apple Vision Pro selling slowly and Apple pulling back dramatically on their manufacturing. Now, first of all, I'm confused because I thought the manufacturing had been curtailed anyway because of supply chain issues. So this sort of supposes that those supply chain issues were solved. We just didn't know about that. But now they're pulling back for sales reasons, which would be insane because I mean, here's the problem in a nutshell. Apple only knows one way of selling things, which is everybody in the world has to know about it. And this is really a developer kit. So they told everybody in the world that it was this great consumer product. They're like 3 years too early. It should have been sold to developers. They could have charged even more to developers, and they wouldn't have had to buy all these flashy TV ads and made like it was a new iPhone. That was so dumb. Why? It's not a new iPhone. It's not even close to being what the iPhone 1.0 was.
Apple feels like, well, let's put it this way. There's an interesting dynamic when me with my instincts and all the stuff I read was that Apple was hoping that they would sell about 400,000 units. Like that felt like the right number for them. So I don't even understand where this news is coming from that they're pulling back on their predictions, because I don't think they want to sell a lot of these things. I think they wanted to seed the market with luxury good buyers and developers and, users from industry and people trying to figure this out and seeing if it was worth, what it is. And it's 4 grand a pop. And that totally makes sense to me as a very sort of not even a first gen device, the half of a first gen device, right?
It's their
So,
marketing machine. They only know how to do one thing. And so
yeah.
Bloomberg's a Apple AXR analyst, Ming Chi Kuo, who reads all the Chinese papers and has a real insider's view, is the one who started this thing last Monday.
Yeah.
And now everybody is piled on, right? Because it's, Apple Schadenfreude.
Sure.
They've done
Everybody
such a
likes
good
to see
job
if
of
they can knock down
bragging.
Apple a peg, right? Yeah.
Oh,
Although Apple stock went way up today, so it's all fine.
it
I
did?
did. Now, I will tell you something that I think is interesting, and I presume this is not a secret to tell. I got a survey, the first ever. Now, I've been in the Apple ecosystem maybe 35, 40 years of my life, buying Apple products, working with Apple. I got a survey from Apple about the Vision Pro. Very in-depth. Tell us what you like about the device. Tell us what you don't like about the device. Would you buy it again? Why would you buy it? Why did you buy it? It was fascinating. So clearly, they got the message from people like us and others saying there's a lot of good about this and there's a lot of trouble in paradise about this thing. And you need to start learning a little more about what your customers are saying. So good on them for putting out a survey, and hopefully they'll take whatever people say to heart. I mean, you know what I said about it because I've been very public about it,
We
So it'll be interesting to see if they.
have so much more to say. I didn't get to talking about Elon Musk saying that Tesla is not a car company. That would have been a pretty interesting chat too. We'll have to save that for
Yeah,
Roni.
save that for next week.
But Yat is here. Let's bring him in.
Okay, sounds
You
good.
don't want to wait. Let Yat see you
Yeah,
wait
we
for
got a
the
lot to
likes
talk
of
about.
us. The world of Web3 waits for no one. Yat, see
Hello.
you. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks for joining us.
No, my pleasure. Absolutely.
We've been waiting for you. We've tried to get you on several other times. So it's
Oh.
exciting to have you actually have you here virtually with us. Thank you.
Yes. No, thank you for having me. It's been a crazy travel schedule, so I'm glad we could make it.
Are you joining us from Taiwan, or where are you in the world?
I'm in Hong Kong right now.
In Hong
I
Kong.
just came in from Thailand, this and then that, but I was in Singapore and I was in Riyadh and Dubai. Like all, it was pretty crazy schedule, but yeah,
It sounds
glad
like
to be
my
back
old
home.
life.
And
Well, nice to
is
have you. We have lots to talk about. Charlie, you should get the ball rolling.
well, I guess it's kind of funny to say it because Animoca Brands has been so important to the metaverse. I won't say you're the most important company in the metaverse, but I would certainly say in terms of influence, Animoca Brands and your vast portfolio. I think you recently released some financials that estimated the portfolio was not fully priced, but someplace in the neighborhood of $1.5 billion. So that's a pretty big, impressive number, and maybe much bigger because we seem to have suddenly the wind in the sails of the metaverse after sort of a long crypto winter dragged down Web3.
Sure. So I think we can talk about it. We didn't just on the financials, we did state that we didn't include the equity value because it was hard to create the
Right.
valuation for that. And the total, I guess the total assets, if we take out the cash, basically the stables and the cash, is, I think it's closer to $2.4 billion, right? In terms of token positions. So I guess. But I guess, I mean, we can talk about this obviously, during the podcast. I think the part of the reason we wanted to also share this, outside the fact that we're a public company, so we do have some financial obligations that we have to release some
Sure.
updates to the market, is that I think a lot of people, if they see the price of tokens and they go, that seems okay, things seem to be good. But actually, there's not been an indication as to what is the health of the companies in the space per se, right? I mean, you've got Coinbase and a few others, but you don't really know much about the rest of the state. So we thought it'd be also helpful for the industry to at least get a glimpse as to, it's not just Bitcoin that's
Well,
doing well.
let's start with maybe the stablecoin phenomenon and your position in it, because
Yeah.
clearly you believe in the concept of stablecoin. You're heavily vested in it across many sort of pieces of that universe. Maybe explain to our listeners the philosophy of a stablecoin, how you fit, how Animoca Brands and your company fits into that philosophy and use case.
Yeah. Okay. So Animoca Brands is currently around $291 million in stablecoins and cash, which we basically sort of reported earlier. But I think the way that you can think of it for us is we think of this really as an onboarding tool for essentially the masses, right? In other words, it's much easier for someone mentally to understand the concept of a, you know, basically a stablecoin as in, okay, it's US dollar denominated, we get it, it's one-to-one. And also I feel like it's something you can trust. I think for the ones who are a little bit more within the vision of Web3, it also has a different flavor than the CBDC as well, which seems a little bit too intrusive to a certain set of people. Although I think most people might not know the difference. For the people in Web3 today, they do know the difference and they do sort of make the distinction. So if they're going to have to do a bridge between the physical and the virtual world, stablecoin seems to be the more natural bridge in terms of value transfer between the two, let's call it universes, if you want.
So it's almost sort of the baby step between fiat currency and cryptocurrency. It's sort of a bridge between the two worlds, right?
Correct. And it is also understood. And I think one of the other things is because of the fact that there is sort of a dollar yield that can be obtained from it in a sense.
Right.
That's something actually you can also translate into it. For us, the reason we keep the amount of stables and cash is because, frankly, a lot of our investments are basically done in stables, right? That's sort of the typical thing, even though we have tokens and we could technically, if we wanted to liquidate them, we look at tokens as a yield instrument and we look at stables basically as our cash flow and operating sort of, I guess, money, just because of the fact that at the end of the day, you know, most of our, not all, but most of our sort of staff, for instance, get paid in dollars or stables or some kind of physical currency. So you know, that hasn't changed yet. And we don't think we'll change anytime soon. So that's kind of why it's so important. Also, I think, you know, there'll be more stablecoin issuances from different countries. I expect Hong Kong, you know, Hong Kong's leading the charge in some ways when you look about the Ethereum spot ETF, which of course is launching, I think, today in Hong Kong. And I think the you know, Hong Kong will also be issuing stablecoins of their own. I think this is important only because, again, it onboards more people into the ecosystem. And again, you know, it's the natural bridge.
So I think from a US listener standpoint, most people would know Animoca Brands with your relationship with Sandbox and the Sandbox gaming infrastructure. Do you want to maybe talk about the sort of arc of Sandbox, its enormous growth, its tying to NFTs, and then maybe where it has arced and where it sits today?
Yeah, so and maybe just to quickly sort of step back a little bit, I think more and more people know Animoca Brands, even in the US, in our involvement in anything related to NFTs, right? So for instance, you know, our partnership and investments in companies like Yuga, for instance, or Cool Cats, right, as well, you know, beyond the Sandbox, and many other sort of, you know, Web3 sort of L1, L2s that we've also been supporting overall, right? And we've done over 400 investments in the space on top of being builders. And I think Sandbox obviously was the one that initially we had sort of the most attention on. It's a subsidiary of Animoca Brands. You know, it basically sort of, I guess, coined, if you will, so the whole sort of open metaverse construct in terms of virtual land ownership, even though that actually has existed in some ways with like Second Life, obviously decades before, but Second Life was a rental concept. Like you couldn't really own it, right? It basically with Second Life, you have to keep paying essentially sort of—
Sort of like condo fees.
Yeah, it's a kind of condo fees. Whereas in Sandbox, you truly own it. And so you have much more of an ownership principle behind this.
And in Decentraland, did you own it or was that a nuance there?
It was investment. So Decentraland actually was a business that when that launched, we made an investment in them. And it was interesting because both Sandbox and Decentraland were literally two blocks away from each other in Buenos Aires back in 2018. And sort of a funny story was that when we made the investment in Decentraland and when we acquired Sandbox, we actually played very briefly with the idea of what would it be like if we actually maybe put those two businesses
together,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Because, you know, back then, 2018, in 2019, the whole sort of, you know, NFT Web3 space, in fact, Web3 wasn't even properly coined, right? Was sort of very, very sort of early. And we're trying to sort of understand sort of how do we, could we create sort of scale in one form or the other. But the two constructs were different. So sandbox could be viewed much more closely to a Roblox Minecraft experience, in the sense that what makes Minecraft and Roblox so powerful is that it's very easy for people to create user-generated content. This is much harder to do in a freeform 3D world back then, just because if someone's building on a 3D world, you need to have skills and you know how to do that. And of course, even though AI today can help you make 3D models much, much easier than ever before, you know, the idea of putting things together in Lego block style is still much more intuitive for people. And that's the reason, by the way, why Roblox and Minecraft are the number one and number two game in the world today, bigger than Fortnite, bigger than PUBG, bigger than any of those games put together, in fact, right? And so I think that was sort of the vision of Sandbox. And it really captured people's imagination in terms of understanding, you know, what this virtual world could be like. And today, there's like hundreds and hundreds of creators that are basically making a living, creating content on Sandbox. And even though Sandbox hasn't fully launched, right, it's basically been launching several alphas, you know, because of the fact that people are creating and selling NFTs, you could think of, and so building communities, you could kind of think of Sandbox as a creator platform that allows creators to essentially monetize their creative endeavors in the metaverse as a jump off point, and then grow the business from there. So I think Snoop Dogg is an interesting example. You know, he launched his first sort of, you know, doggies on the Sandbox, created a community, sort of built his hood literally in the Sandbox, created a presence. And then from there on, he actually branched out into other areas of the metaverse, right? So I think of Sandbox like sort of this launch pad into the open metaverse, into the wider Web3 space, which is also something that's understood because there's a community. And this is the other reason why finance organizations also ended up sort of buying land and building on it, because basically all the landowners in Sandbox basically have somewhere between $500,000 to $1 million worth of assets in their wallet that you can see. And so, you know, I think a lot of people sometimes think of, you know, oh, you know, in Web3 or just generally in the web, you have millions of customers. But actually, you know, the number of actual customers on Sotheby's, which is, you know, multi-billion-dollar enterprise, is 200,000, right? So it's 200,000, well, people who just auction on art, for instance, right? And so when you think of it that way, the net purchasing power of every landowner in Sandbox is tremendous, which is also the value of what you have in the Yuga ecosystem with people who own Bored Apes, right? Every person who owns one Bored Ape at least has $50,000 to $100,000 of value to their name, and probably a lot more, right? So again, it's not that different, right? You don't have 10 million Rolex owners. You don't have 10 million Ferrari owners, right? You have a much smaller number, but these are a premier customer base. And that's kind of how sort of Sandbox's initial sort of starting point is. And of course, with the Sand token, it sort of branches out that framework, that community network, even wider.
Yeah, that's interesting. I do remember that there was an association with Sandbox and Bored Apes, and I could never really quite figure out what the connection was, but you just explained it pretty well. It's actually, you're talking about effectively what we would call high net worth crypto individuals that actually, you know, whether those assets are worth anything in the future is an unknown, but they are perceived as worth something now because they can be traded for something, you know, and there was a height of that Bored Apes market that has dulled considerably. But what you're saying is these are still considered high value, high net worth assets that a small number of people have and utilize
so in the
luxury goods market.
Correct. They're status symbols, but and sort of classic Veblen goods. But I think one of the things to also think about, and the way we think about tokens in general, including non-fungible tokens, is that we basically think of them as representations of network effects. And so when you think of these representations of network effects, and for the first time, by the way, network effects that are both utility and financial can come together because of the blockchain, right? That's something that you couldn't do before. Mm-hmm. And so therefore you could sort of understand the financial network effect and translate that into the utility network effects, which today we kind of do, but in imperfect ways. Like for instance, if someone has 1 million followers on Instagram, we go like, oh, I think he's important, right? But you know, is he really important? We don't really know, but we make these assumptions. Or, oh, he drives a Ferrari, so I think he's important. Or he has money, but do we really know if it's his Ferrari or not? Right? Like all these things are sort of people guesstimates and estimates that people do. Or when someone basically posts a photo on Instagram next to a private jet, do we actually know that he owns a private jet or not? Like these are all these things, whereas on Web3 is absolutely certain. It's in your wallet, right? And it's yours, and how many assets you have. And I think the other thing is that when you merge these network effects, this is when we think about interoperability, those network effects amplify. So in other words, when you have interoperability between NFTs and one game to another game, or when we, so for instance, there's a lot of Bored Ape holders build experiences in Sandbox. A lot of Sandbox owners have you know, participation in Apecoin, for instance, and so on. These networks commingle with each other, but actually they enhance these network effects. And that's one of the real powers of Web3. And we see these, by the way, this in another way, which is with fungible tokens, when they sort of interoperate with each other, where like they have bridges across one chain to the other. Actually, what happens is those network effects amplify. And you can see this in sort of TVL expanding in different places, because now you're able to move liquidity around, which you couldn't do before. Like, one mental model is, imagine what would happen if Facebook and Google and Apple actually merged their networks and there were permissionless bridges, hypothetically, never going to happen, right? But hypothetically, there were permissionless bridges that could actually connect to each other. What would happen? Well, it wouldn't just be a value increment of 10 or 20%. It would explode the value of Web2 in this case, because you'd have so many more use cases and utility and participation and openness in the networks, kind of like how much open source mushroom. Of course, that's never going to happen. And that's what
There's a version of that that actually does happen, because in iOS, Apple licenses Google and the Google APIs to provide search. And
but it's a tenuous bridge. It's a tenuous
bridge. It's a very tenuous bridge, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And so the point is that it's not permissionless, which means be taken away. Right. And the only reason why that bridge exists is because I think of it a little bit like two superpowers that are kind of holding each other in check, right? But if any one of them starts to have significantly less power than the other, that bridge will go, right? And it will completely change. And that's the relationship that app developers have, for instance, anyone else that accesses APIs with them. If you are a smaller company, then basically you are dependent on them. You're their subjects, as opposed to one that really what we don't have is a permissionless nature. We have essentially a balance of power, right? Which is a slightly different situation. Yeah.
So would you say, so it's interesting hearing you talk, because I don't want to put words in your mouth, so you have to confirm this or not, that more than anything, Anna Mocha believes in the essence of the blockchain, in the idea of the open public ledger and the accountability of the users, their actual value inside these networks, inside these games, inside these experiences. And that's your bet. That's what you and your investors are betting on. Would that be
correct? Our principle, absolutely. Our principle that we say a lot is that we call it basically sharing the network, right? And we believe in the principle of a shared network. And we therefore don't believe you can win in a zero-sum way in Web3, which is a reason we do so many investments in the space. And we think of it as building an economy rather than building a company, right? And I think and this also means that we think that the ecosystem is also healthier, because you know, in order to keep participating in the space, we have to keep reinvesting in the space. We don't reinvest in ourselves. We invest in the space as a whole. Now, here's another mental model that I often like to talk about, which is, imagine if the top 10 companies in the world, which are mostly tech companies except one, actually created a VC fund to basically invest in the ecosystem. Take Apple. I think $163 billion of cash sitting mostly in Ireland. So let's take 10% of that cash and put it back into anything that develops on the App Store. That's a $16+ billion seed Series A fund.
The ecosystem.
Which is bigger than any... ecosystem. That's much bigger than anything. That's bigger than any VC put together in that kind of fund. What do you think will happen? Well, the App Store ecosystem would flourish. People would be more than happy to pay their 30%. There would be basically not a situation where small developers would be squeezed out. The returns, by the way, I think would be better, because you know, Apple would hold minority positions in companies that would succeed in their space rather than just having cash. And capital becomes productive, which is the main point here, right? Which is the problem right now we have in the world, where capital basically sits there. And because of the fact that it just accrues, actually it's unproductive. It doesn't help create employment. It doesn't create industries. Right. It doesn't create growth. And so I think Apple is a country. I think Facebook is a country, but they don't have that mental model. So they extract.
But they're guarding that capital. Yeah, it's interesting, because Roblox, when you read some financial statistics about Roblox, they put way more investment back into their product than any other company that I know of. They invest in their user base and their user growth, and they put money, they put their profits, they return their profits back into enhancing the product so that these developers can build more content inside that ecosystem. So Roblox is almost the more utopian model of return the profit that they make back to their users in a fashion. Yeah.
In a fashion, except that the network effects remain limited because they are a closed ecosystem.
Right.
So when you actually start opening up, you kind of have the same effect you have, you know, when you know, the WTO started to be established in the world and you had free trade and they all started to interoperate with each other, then you have growth. And that's kind of the scenario we have in Web3 right now, which is why even though we have so far so many few users in comparison to, you know, Web2, the financial strength and the economic opportunities are significant. Like the scale of countries, right? Imagine you had a country that had tens of millions of people. That's a big economy, right? But in Web2, that's basically nothing. And the mental model I have on this one is that I think Web2 is basically existing a little bit like North Korea, right? Which is basically no property rights, low value, right? Lots of people, by the way, right? Lots of people doing utility stuff, but zero investment potential and therefore zero sort of capital appreciation and capital formation. And then you can go to a small place like Hong Kong or a small place like Switzerland, which has, you know, basically like almost 10 times less the population, but it has, you know, I don't know, hundreds of times more of the value from
their GDP because of the fact that
it is an open network. Yeah, GDP is way higher, right? You can't even compare the two places, right? And so what? So the Web2 world is predominantly versions of North Korea, big and small, that basically sort of hoard these network effects, and then they create sort of balance of power type tenuous relationships with each other in terms of what they can trade. But it's always a friction, right? It's always a friction, one form or the other, in terms of the data and the stuff that they're willing to trade with each other, whereas in Web3 is entirely permissionless, which is how most of the physical world seems to operate.
Charlie, my next questions are going to be what Yat does for fun. So I want to let you break in here and ask anything you might be on your mind.
Well, you know, of course, I mean, it's very interesting philosophy that of the brands to the value of the users, and you're dealing with essentially a very rarefied group of people who are savvy in the ways of the crypto Web3 economy, which is a small group of people. But I guess your thesis is, yes, it's a small group of people. It's not billions of people, but these are very high
not yet
value
not
users. Yet. Right. So I'd rather have, it's sort of the way Apple is, right? They don't own the majority of phones. They just own the majority of users who are more high value. So is that sort of a good way of describing the way you're looking at?
That's the world today. And so it's the world today, but that's not our vision. So our mission is to create, obviously, mass adoption of Web3. And to create mass adoption of Web3, what we discovered was we need to enhance financial literacy. So what you're talking about, the person who understands value, is someone who's financially literate, which is very different from Apple's perspective, by the way. They make money, but that doesn't mean they're financially literate. Like, you'd be a great artist, and you can make a lot of money, you can be a great musician, and you could make a good income, but that's more along the lines of a labor value, which, by the way, I think is the classic way that most people still think in the world today. So just having a bank account doesn't make you financially included. And I think the thing about onboarding on Web3 successfully, as we've seen for Web3 games, for instance, in our experience on Sandbox, is that actually when you start to understanding capital value and you become a true capitalist in the truest form of its intention, because now you own assets, right, and you're investing in the space, that's actually when you start to understand financial literacy truly. And again, we're not saying you have to be a Warren Buffett style investor. You just have to understand that, you know, the world is uncertain and that there's risk, and, you know, everyone probably who's listening to this chat and everyone here obviously understands that, but the mass majority of the world doesn't.
Well, how do you democratize that?
So this is why Web3 is so fascinating, because in Web3, so we believe in this construct, in what we call kind of eventually a future where there will be universal basic equity, because everyone can own a stake in the networks they construct. So when you think about something, even holding tokens, let's call it Ethereum or Solana or SAN tokens, actually, by owning tokens, you become a stakeholder, not quite a shareholder, but a stakeholder, because you're now an owner in the network effects of the network you're building. Like, imagine if Instagram had a token, hypothetically, let's dream a little bit, right? And everyone who's sharing photos would then receive a stake in that network. They actually grow with the value of the network, and their participation becomes stronger and more powerful, which makes them capitalists. But basically, everyone in those platforms today are actually, in the truest sense, free labor. Basically sharing photos, creating data, creating value, and then they extract it. The capitalists are the shareholders and the actual, you know, I guess, creators and owners of the business, like the entrepreneurs, but it's not actually the people who are contributing to these networks. Like, again, you know, I go back to this example of, you know, if Apple was to invest in the ecosystem, or what would happen, for instance, you know, if every Uber driver in the world actually owned a small share in, you know, having Uber shares, right? Then when Uber eventually replaces all the drivers, which they will do, because they've kind of said that, right? Because for self-driving cars, there wouldn't be the same friction. They'd also create a better outcome. And everyone would work for the common good of the network, right? Which is, in this case, Uber. I mean, if they were thinking this way, right? And so this is Web3. So, and in Web3, because of token structures, you can have 10 million holders. You can have 100 million holders. But you can't do that in a share company. Like, we're a public company. We have 2,800 shareholders. It's already one heck of an effort to basically inform our shareholders for a shareholder vote, because we have to print that. I think some of the biggest companies in the world, like Apple and Facebook, have somewhere between 30 to 80,000 shareholders, which is a big number. But you can't have a million shareholders. You can't administratively manage that. Right,
it's impossible. Right.
Yeah, but you can manage a million token holders.
Well, and what's interesting, what you're talking about, is so fascinating to listen to you talk, because what you're referring to, and this will sound a little heretical and disruptive, is we know the concepts of capitalism, and we know the concepts of socialism. But what you're actually talking about is blending capitalism and socialism in a new chemistry that allows some of the benefits of capitalism and some of the scale and use case of spreading the wealth, which we call socialism, right? And a common good, but in a new sort of way. And what you're referring to in your lexicon is, you say that's the Web3 way of thinking, is that it's capitalism and socialism all at the same time.
Well,
which I think a lot of financial people would highly disagree with, but I think it's fascinating.
Yes. So the way that I would we translate this as stakeholder capitalism as opposed to shareholder capitalism. We see the current form of the world as a shareholder capitalism version, and we see the Web3 world with its token structures and the network effects that you can now own as stakeholder capitalism. Mm. We don't think it's socialism. And the reason we don't think it's socialism is because socialism normally requires a central power to direct you, which is not Web3, right? So we think Web3 still maintains, because of its decentralized structures and its permission structure, essentially the liberalist capitalist values of essentially how
that's kind of what I was saying is it's a new chemistry of the concept, because there's a concept but in a different way.
I'm listening to
you, but it is a common good. It is a common good, though. Please go ahead.
It's interesting.
So Ted, I'm listening to Yat talk, and I'm thinking we should start a movie studio that is run on tokenization. We'll get, you know, Yat behind us, and you and I both have jobs.
Well, there have been people threatening, and some that have attempted. Like, there's a company called Legion M. I'm actually curious, does Animoca invest in Legion M? Do you know what Legion M is? It's like a decentralized movie studio that runs on the blockchain, that actually allows people to invest micro investments inside movies, and fans get to sort of promote their projects up into the world.
So we invested in a company called MoviePass, which is doing quite well. And it's kind of a sort of our segue into that as well. So I think there's some similar ideas that they're thinking about. So we're not, we're not involved with Legion, but anyway. So
you invested in the 2.0 movie pass, in the new movie pass.
Yeah, in the new movie.
Yeah, because there's a great documentary. Exactly. I saw it at South by Southwest.
Gen 1, I heard. I have
the disaster, the rise of the Phoenix, and they're back at it. And it's kind of fascinating.
They're back at it. No, it's fascinating. But yes, basically, I guess just to summarize this, though, that whether it's movies, whether it's music, whether it's games, whether it's anything we do, right? Basically, now you have a way in which you can basically create networks that are co-owned by the very communities that are your biggest fans and your biggest endorsers. And in so doing, we change your relationships of fans and users into basically stakeholders and co-owners. And I think that's kind of how the world will ultimately look like. And I think, therefore, we will create more equity, right? Because you don't have this concentration of wealth issue, because Web3 is inherently, in our view, anti-monopolistic. And by that, I mean, because our data structure is open, you can basically do vampire attacks any day you want, right? Which basically prevents these sort of monopolies from forming. Whereas in the monopoly framework, which you have in Web2, you just kind of, basically it's an iron fortress. I can't access your database. I don't know. I don't have permission to do any of that. And therefore, as that happens, I create a monopoly, because that's the other thing about data, is that the value of data and the network effects it forms compounds. So the more data you have and the more data you essentially sort of aggregate, the more powerful it becomes, right? And so you have these sort of, fortresses around the world. I call them the Web2 kingdoms, right? That are essentially sort of guarding them, because they know that once they open it up, right? They actually sort of are, they're being vampire attacked effectively themselves. They lose the networks because they don't have a framework of which they can protect it.
Would you agree or disagree that Linux was a form of this, was an attempt?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, I think it's more than an attempt. It was successful in a sense that open source as a movement was successful. So open source is an example of where the network effects of open source was so big that no single company in the world can now sort of go out and say, you know what, when it comes to code, not the data it's created, but the code, I have to basically build open source.
Yeah.
But the thing about open source is I think of it a little bit as the barter age of value, right? We're bartering my code with your code. Right. And so with Web3, we can now go and move more into the money age where we can now basically sort of have a stake. Like, to me, the future of open source should mean that every person who contributes actually becomes a stakeholder in the code, which they're not today. Right. You only get still labor equivalent of value in terms of, OK, yeah, I did some code. That's great. I can use the code myself for value, but I don't get a share in the value they've created. So if you created a company like Xiaomi, for instance, or Lenovo from the open source code, well, the person who created the code doesn't get a sort of micro percentage of that. But again, in Web3, you can do that. Like, imagine, for instance, this is one of the things we like about sort of what's happening with AI. With Gen AI, if I'm actually generating sort of knowledge from some AI I've created, some image or some data, through blockchain, I would be able to audit, you know, the 10,000 sources or 100,000 sources I've created inspiration from creating this. In Web3, I can pay out a reward to 10,000 or 100,000 people in a microfractional version, which again, you cannot do in the traditional Web2 ways, right? So you can kind of see how that scales. And so therefore, it's not unrealistic to think that there's a future where we're all stakeholders in one form or the other, and therefore all capitalists.
So do you think in the long term, let's talk about many years in the future, where you sit today with kind of the ultra wealthy class, you know, in reference to Ferraris and private jets and all these things, starts to go away, that we start to level the playing field? Ultimately?
In fact, I don't think it's going to happen. I think quite the opposite. So because I think, to me, money is a means to a social end for most people. For a small percentage of the world, money is a means in itself. But for most people, money is a social end. But in other words, once you've reached your, you know, like if you look at classic sort of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and you basically reached essentially all the things that you're able, you know, in this case, you know, send your kids to school and you live reasonably well and you at least have a, you know, a roof under your head and you have to worry about that stuff. Then you start thinking about other forms in which you enhance your social status, right? And by the way, that doesn't necessarily mean that it must mean to be expensive goods. But when you think about people who, you know, buy green or want to be sustainable or care about solar energy, like these are all other forms of social connections that people have. And we're willing to pay more money for those things because they mean something to us. Right. So what I'm saying is that we'll reach a higher plane. For some people, that means owning a Ferrari. And for some people, it means essentially traveling to the Amazon forest, right? It doesn't matter, right? Like the amount of travel, for instance, and whether you call it high-end travel or ecotourism has been incredibly on the rise, which are not cheap, by the way, right? For the same reason. Right. And then people sort of express it that way and say, hey, I just visited this place and it's amazing. And on one hand, people go, that's really cool. On the other hand, you feel really good for having done that. Right. So these type of things will continue to increase. And I think it just becomes broadly more accessible because essentially we'll have more ability to create that type of, I guess, leisure activity because you have sources of wealth and income that comes from that. And I think, you know, when you think about, you know, the anomaly of the last 30, 40 years where you had a rising middle class, which obviously has gone away in the last, let's call it 10, 20 years, right? You had a period in time post-war where the middle class was broadly rising, especially in America, right? This promise of this hope that you could sort of be there essentially created stability as well, because you knew you had the opportunity of doing this. I think the state of the world we have today, like post-COVID, there was $42 trillion of new wealth created, $42 trillion. Two-thirds of that wealth went to the one percentile of the world.
Sure.
Right, right. And basically the rest went to everyone else. Right, so, and then of course, you know, QE and, you know, inflation just made it even worse, right? So it just adds a sort of cherry on top, right? And then we wonder why people are like, the world is kind of messed up, and it's really hard to sort of pull that back. And I think, and so again, I do, you know, I really do believe that Web3 is the answer for that. And I think some countries in the world do understand this better than others. Like I think Hong Kong has been really forward on this one. Hong Kong has gone through its own crises, particularly with youth. That's the other thing. Who are the ones who are suffering the most in this sort of inequity is the youth, right? And if your youth is screwed, your future is screwed, actually. And I think this is universal, right? So Web3 nativity, digital nativity, is actually what they understand best. And also their status signaling is all essentially digital anyway. So in that sense, right. The physical doesn't matter. So maybe when we think, maybe it won't be Ferraris, maybe it'll be more kind of Bored Apes, or maybe it'd be kind of virtual status symbols. Like for instance, the kids, when you know what they covet are the rare items on Roblox, for instance.
Yeah, sure.
They don't covet, like a Gucci item or something, right? It's totally different.
Yeah, I mean, the culture's changed, right? But I mean, you make some interesting points, and some of the things I often think about is where the playing fields do get leveled. When it relates to technological advancement, it often levels the playing field. So when you think about the massive population that effectively almost have the same mobile technology now, right? There are sort of low-end, medium-end, and high-end Android phones and medium-end and high-end iPhones. But everybody sort of has the same one, right? Like
yes,
the people that live in third world countries and the people that live in first world countries, there is not a big delta between the Android phones that they have that they can buy on the street and put prepaid on, and then the higher end sort of top of the line Google or Samsung phones. There's not that big of a delta, right? Cars is another really good example. The difference between a $700,000 Ferrari and a $30,000 Prius is actually not that massive. It's now certainly there's an exoticness to a car that costs $700,000 and can go that fast. But truthfully, a Prius and a Ferrari are almost the same thing, right? And that's
absolutely
kind of the logic that you're sort of trying to get to in Web3.
It is too.
You sort of level the playing field, which is kind of interesting. It's an interesting
piece. Yeah, you level the playing field, but at the end, we're all still social creatures, and we all still seek forms of social validation.
We crave that exclusivity and believability of something special. Yeah, yeah.
And I think in many ways, money has become the proxy for social status, but it wasn't always like that, right? So for instance, if you were a professor, you had social status, but you didn't have to make that much money. And you were respected in the community. So I think what people seek for
is
the money itself. but anyway, I think this comes to, you know, when there was a time where labor was more valuable or as valuable as capital, that would work. But that doesn't work anymore. And I think those days are gone. Right. So we need to reframe our thinking, and we need to rethink our economics and our economic participation. Which also means, by the way, we need to teach financial literacy to our kids right at primary school.
Right. So I know we've talked about a lot of high-minded stuff. This is a fascinating conversation, but I know we're getting close to the end. I think our listeners would love to know a little bit about you, your background, how you came to this role, and what do you do other than running Animoca? What do you do for fun in the world of Web3? What do you do? What do you do all day?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess very, very quickly, since I know we're short on time. So I grew up in Austria. I'm a child of the 70s. And so for those who might remember, that was a time when there was still an iron curtain between basically East and West Europe. And my mom was a musician. So I came from a creative background. I studied music myself, where I basically firsthand got to see the world of music and creators and frankly, how they got abused by money managers. So that's another little backstory, which we don't have to go into today. But my mom used to work in Eastern Germany, East Berlin, at the Komische Oper. And I would visit her. And so this gave me, I grew up in Austria in a socially democratic country, which is more socialist than capitalist for sure. In a world, by the way, where people don't talk about money. And then I go across to sort of the eastern side of Berlin when I visit my mom, and I see a world that is truly communist and see what that is. And that definitely has an impact on me. I got involved into technology because I wasn't great at, you know, music in comparison to my peers. So I wrote composition software that eventually landed me a job at Atari, which then led me to the US. And in the US, I experienced, capitalism in all its glory, and all its issues as well. And then from there, I ended up coming to Hong Kong, starting one of Hong Kong's very first internet service providers called Hong Kong Online in the early 90s, where I literally experienced, capitalism on steroids, where basically I like to sometimes call it sort of I guess, Milton Friedman's wet dream, in the sense of the fact that it was really just all about sort of, you know, sort of capitalism in its most extreme
right,
form,
the
which
rawest
they had
form
to also alter.
Yeah, sure.
The rawest form. I mean, in the 90s, Hong Kong was capitalism in its absolutely
sure.
rawest
I was there.
Form. I mean, there
I
was
remember.
No social security, like
yes.
none of that sort, like all that stuff, right? It was just like literally sort of, you know, sort of a make it or break it type of thing. And so I think that cycle of things has sort of made me think about the world in certain ways. Because I was a tech entrepreneur, I was very early in open source, built my entire infrastructure. You know, we built one of the world's largest email service providers, which was essentially a cloud computing business that was sold to IBM on the back of open source. And I think sort of that basically gave us sort of much of that inspiration about sort of, I guess, the open web. And then maybe just to top off that sort of background story before I go to my personal stuff is, you know, when we were one of the biggest app developers on the App Store, you know, when we sold the business to IBM, we basically went into mobile games and mobile applications. In 2012, we had 12 out of the top 20 apps on the App Store in various countries around the world. And Apple removed all of our apps in one fell swoop.
Wow.
And never gave us a true reason. You know, the rumor was that we violated the App Store rules. Duh, right? The only thing is, like, what rules and why and whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think the most insidious thing about that censorship wasn't the fact that, you know, we got removed, was the fact that we were silenced for fear of not being able to come back again, right? Which is kind of what tyranny does to you. Right? And I think this was not the world that we sort of signed up for. This was not what the internet was supposed to do. And that was really the advent of what happened when you had these closed gateways, where frankly, I don't even know that someone at Apple at the high levels even knew, some executive somewhere just said, we don't like these guys, they're based in Hong Kong, messing up the way that we think of the App Store ranking, so we'll delete you. Basically playing God, which is what happens when you have dictatorships and tyranny and all that kind of stuff. And you know, today, you know, as you may have noticed, Apple just simply removed the rankings completely because
right.
they basically felt that was messing with their construction of how the world should look like.
Right.
And I think there goes the issue, which is that Apple removed, by removing the App Store rankings of any form, they actually removed the market, right? Because the market is a signal, right?
Because they want to control
market.
The market. They don't want an open
yes.
market to be out there. They
yes,
want to control
exactly,
it.
Yeah. Exactly. And so actually I would argue that Apple and those companies that do this are actually anti-capitalist, right? They're not just monopolists, they're anti-capitalist, right? Because capitalism requires a free and fair market. And what they have with the App Store is a market. And again, this is why Web3 is so interesting. And so I'm a big believer in this. And I think this creates, you know, like true competition is what creates a fairer market, right? And we don't have true and fair competition in the world of Web2, as much as they try to pretend to say it. And our antitrust laws were designed to protect us from this stuff. And frankly, they're just unable to because the constructs are not there. But, you know, technology often comes with solutions on problems that exist in the world, right? And so I do spend a lot of time thinking about this. This is my life's work, I would say. You know, digital property rights for us, when we talk about that, is a foundation because property rights is a foundation for capitalism, right? So we think that's important. You know, other than that, you know, proud father of three kids, happily married for like, you know, 20 odd years. You know, my oldest is already working. Right. So I'm sort of, it gives me a little bit more time to essentially travel what I do. I do read a lot of philosophy and study economics. I'm not a philosopher, just to be clear, but it interests me only because of the fact that it covers the work that we do. I used to study history as well. So that's something, you know, I love to read if I can. So these are things that sort of help me shape and think. And of course, you know, I love to hike and bike if I can. That's a little less these days, but yeah.
I would argue you are a modern philosopher. If nothing that we learned over the last year is you are very deep into the philosophy of a modern economy and a modern workforce and a modern society. It's very interesting to listen to you talk.
You know, when I was Thank young you. And I'd listen to people like that, I would say, someday I'm going to be as smart as that guy. But I think it may be too late for me now.
I think our ship has sailed, Charlie.
So thank you for sharing your wisdom and insight with us today. I'm really, really flattered and grateful you came on the show and shared your perspective with us. So many questions. This is like every interview we do, we feel like we don't have enough time. And certainly in your case, with so many companies in your portfolio, I wanted to ask you about. So hopefully we'll be able to get you back. I know you're hard to pin down, but we'll do our best. And thank you again. Have a great day.
Yeah, we would love to have you Thank back. You. Anytime you have an announcement or something you want to bring out to the U.S. Or the world,
yeah, barge on in here.
Consider us.
That's right.
We'll talk about it.
We'll kick off whatever guest for you.
Absolutely. Very interesting.
Thank you so much. But it's been a real pleasure and an honor to be on your show. Thank you.
Very fun.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thank you.